Support for The Common comes from the law firm of Davis Malm. Whether you're a private business, a public company, a municipality, a nonprofit, or in-house counsel, their business attorneys help achieve your short and long-term goals. DavisMalm.com, DavisMalm.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Darryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. Andrew Brinker, welcome back to The Common.
Thanks for having me. I've missed being here.
Oh, man, that warms my heart. So, Andrew, you're a Boston Globe housing reporter, and you have a story out about efforts to build new federally subsidized public housing units in Massachusetts. And, you know, basically that's housing that's government-owned and operated. And what's interesting is this is happening because of a loophole in a law from the 1990s that effectively ended the building of public housing. And that law, which was passed in 1999, is called the Faircloth Amendment. So take us back to that time and talk to us about what's in this law.
Yeah, it's a really interesting law. It was sort of the culmination of this movement against public housing in the United States. Construction of public housing probably started in the 20s and 30s and sort of stretched all the way through up until really in large scale up until the 80s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there had been lawmakers who had a negative perception of that kind of housing. They associated it with slums or, mm-hmm. you know, they associated it with concentrated poverty or crime or those sorts of things.
While disinvesting in it.
Yeah, they built it, didn't fund it, and then they started associating those things with it. And so Faircloth Amendment was sort of the culmination of that whole sort of movement against public housing. And what the law did was it said, on the federal level and for each housing authority in each community in the United States, the number of federally subsidized public housing units, you know, those really deeply affordable housing units that are owned by the government, the number that each of those communities had at that time in 1999, that was the cap. They could not build any more. And so essentially it was outlawing the construction of public housing. It was saying, as a country, we are done with this, essentially was the idea.
And so, Andrew, how many units short are we from the Faircloth cap in Massachusetts right now?
Yeah, good question. So essentially, since the Faircloth Amendment was passed, we'd already been not investing in public housing to a particularly high degree, and that sort of continued in the decades to follow the Faircloth Amendment. And so what that means is that public housing was really on the decline. The buildings were, I mean. So they were deteriorating. Some of them were redeveloped into mixed income housing. Some of them were just straight up demolished. Some of them were developed into market rate housing. Point being, you know, we've lost quite a few units since then. Mm-hmm. The United States has lost around 235,000 public housing units. So that's 235,000 units below that cap. And Massachusetts has lost around 6,000 units.
And that's a big deal because, like you said, public housing is a major resource for some of the lowest income renters from around the country and locally. So tell me about the initiative called Faircloth to Rad. How could it help us build more of these public housing units?
The general idea behind what's happening right now is that the Faircloth Amendment said the number of public housing units that were subsidized by the federal government in 1999, the total number, which I can't remember the number off the top of my head, I think it was around 1.4 million. That number of public housing units was the cap. And because, you know, in the decades to follow, we've lost so many units, technically speaking, housing authorities have the legal authority to build back to that cap again. It's just a matter of unlocking the funding that's necessary to do so.
So tell me about what's happening here in Massachusetts. Tell me about how they're unlocking the funding and how they're making it happen.
There's this underlying program that the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has sort of been fiddling around with over the last couple of years called the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program that essentially allows housing authorities to transition their public housing, which in housing speak is known as Section 9 housing, to transition it to Section 8. And the general idea behind that is that the payment standard for that Section 9 public housing is not very good. And that's, you know, the funding level, a funding level that the federal government itself sets, that Congress generally sets. And it's viewed as unstable. You know, we've been talking about the fraught politics behind public housing. So that Section 9 housing makes it really difficult to do a redevelopment, to build a new building, all these sorts of things. So this Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, or RAD for short, allows housing authorities to transition from Section 9, transition their buildings, I should say, from Section 9 to Section 8. And Section 8 is this voucher program, you know, that is a more traditional form of affordable housing that can either be, you know, a voucher can either go to a person who can then take that voucher into the private market and secure a subsidized rent that way, or the voucher can be attached to a project. And that's what we're talking about here. So transitioning from Section 9 to Section 8, and the general idea is that Section 8 has, first of all, a higher payment standard, and second of all, is considered to be, generally speaking, a little bit more stable. And so this new program that we're talking about that is allowing the new construction of public housing is taking that RAD program and combining it with these principles behind the Faircloth Amendment. So this new program is called Faircloth to RAD. And the idea is it's doing the same thing. It's allowing housing authorities to go from Section 9 to Section 8, but it's the federal government giving them pre-approval to do that. Essentially, it makes it easier for housing authorities to then go out, go to debt lenders, and get the construction loan that they need to finance that project.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you're a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Okay, so we're getting a little wonky here, but what I understand you're saying is that basically under this Faircloth to RAD program, housing authorities are going to have access to more financial support from the federal government to build back some of the public housing stock we've lost over the last 2+ decades. Do I have that right?
Right.
And right now in Massachusetts, Cambridge is leading the charge with this, correct?
That's right, yeah. So Cambridge has about a fourth of the total units that Massachusetts is under its cap. I think it's around 1,900 units. And so what Cambridge is doing is it has two decent-sized projects. They're both redevelopments in which the housing authority there is adding new units on. So there's a redevelopment of a federally funded building in Central Square. There's 38 units there already, and the housing authority is adding 24 new studio apartments that will be public housing there through this program. So that's 24 new apartments that pretty much could not have been built before. And then there's another new redevelopment a much bigger one in North Cambridge. There's an existing property called Jefferson Park. It's about 175 units right now. They're demolishing it, rebuilding it, and adding 100 new units onto it. So it's going to be 275 total units by the time this project is done.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Cambridge is even looking to build outside of its city.
Yes. The way housing authorities work is that they are technically not associated with town-level government or city-level government. Cambridge is, first of all, a dense community, and they've got, you know, 1,900 units to build, essentially. So Cambridge is looking elsewhere because they've got so many units that they can still build. They're looking to Medford, for example, a community sort of just in that inner ring of suburbs outside of Boston. And they're in very early talks, but the idea is they might be building or helping redevelop some public housing there and adding some new units.
This Faircloth to RAD program, how useful could it be in Boston?
It could potentially be huge. Kenzie Bach, the executive director at the Boston Housing Authority, has told me for this story that not only are they actively exploring the program, they haven't necessarily figured out the best way to work out the funding so far, but they intend to build every single one of the units that they have in their cap space. And that's 2,900 units, almost 3,000 units they've lost since the cap was passed. And it's hard to say what form that might take. It could come in a bigger development of a, you know, of a mixed use project or something like that. The West End Library, for example, the city is redeveloping. They're adding housing on top. Kenzie Bach at the Boston Housing Authority wants to add 20 units of new public housing there. The city has been talking about utilizing some of the vacant land. Theoretically, this is what she told me. Theoretically, they could target some of that vacant land and build entirely new public housing developments there. So they're in the very early stages of figuring out how to use this program, because working out the funding is still complex. But once they figure it out, they have every intention to build all 3,000 of those units.
Over the course of your reporting, and whether it was here in Boston or in Cambridge or wherever it might have been, did you get a chance to talk to any families or community leaders about how impactful this new housing could be?
Yeah, I have been talking to families. The thing that strikes me is that the conditions in our public housing as it stands right now are, as a number of folks have said it, deplorable. I've been through a couple of these units. You know, there are really bad rodent problems. There are staircases that are falling apart, all these really bad issues. And yet the people that live there are still really thankful for the fact that they get to live in a place where, you know, they have a stable home at a rent that they can afford. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we've talked about, we have this really dire housing shortage where the kind of housing that we need the most is this sort of extremely low income, affordable housing that will get people, that will keep people here, essentially. The folks who may be in danger of being priced out of Boston, that will keep people here. So I think the significance is huge, you know, potentially being able to build 6,000 new, deeply affordable units in the context of our housing crisis. I think it's hard to understate how important that could be. And, you know, like we said, it will be challenging to build all these units for a number of reasons. But I think a lot of folks in the housing world see this as a big moment.
With that said, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to come through and talk to us about this story, this very complicated yet important story. Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me, Daryl.
That's Boston Globe housing reporter Andrew Brinker. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. Do we need more public housing? I know that might be such a layup question for some of y'all, but I'm curious to know what you think. Hit us up on Instagram at WBURTheCommon or send us an email at thecommon@wbur.org. I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and I'll talk to you soon.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer a cute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.